Well, let's get going here. We have one item on our agenda today. The bill that was scheduled has been postponed to a different time. And we're going to hear from the Security Hospital. When you get a quorum, we'll move our minutes. We're not even close to that yet, are we? Welcome to those faithful people who came to this hearing today to learn about the important matters that this committee deals with. There's some other conflict at 1 o'clock with something else is going on. I don't know about it. I think it turns 1 o'clock. We're going to do our diligence on this topic, and when we get done, we will stop. I don't think we'll be filling up the entire hour and 45 minutes. But if it turns into that, then I'm comfortable with that, so people can come and go and spy at your map and then come back later. Whatever. Anyway, so with that, in your handouts, you'll see this new HMO in Minnesota, which is kind of interesting. There's a little news article about that. And Epson Huntley, you want to comment about that at all? Do you know about this more than I do?
Well, it's the first one in a long time, and it relates to a different interesting problem we have is cross-border health plans. This is one that's headquartered mainly in Wisconsin, but they do business in Minnesota. The western part of our state, we have Sanford, which is based in South Dakota, and they do business in North Dakota and all of western Minnesota. Plus, we've got Mayo Clinic that does Wisconsin and Iowa, and the Duluth Clinic that does Wisconsin and North Dakota. So we have lots of cross-border issues we have to deal with.
Yeah. Anyway, if that's kind of some news, good point. Okay. Anyway, so Representative Moore, you can sit up here with us if you'd like and have the privilege of the floor if you'd like. So make yourself at home. Nice to have you here. You don't count toward our quorum, unfortunately, however. We could have an exchange program. We can swap you with some other people. we'll be voting on that later as a committee. Anyway, Ms. Berry, welcome to the committee, and you have some things queued up to tell us, so the time is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Ann Berry. I'm the Deputy Commissioner with the Minnesota Department of Human Services. With me today is Dr. Stephen Pratt, and we will both be providing you with an update on the Minnesota Security Hospital. I believe in your packets was where I will start, which is a letter that came to the department on December 22nd of last year. That letter came to Mr. Prophet, David Prophet, and it was the determination of maltreatment, an order to pay a fine, and an order of a conditional license. Those are three separate things I want to talk about. The first thing was that our licensing division and the commissioner wearing her hat as the chief compliance officer for the state.
Ms. Berry, we now have a quorum, so now your comments are official. We'll come to order and welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So in her role as providing oversight to the licensing activities of the state in the Department of Human Services, the commissioner ordered three things. One was a finding of maltreatment. There were actually two incidents of maltreatment. If you look at page 3 of that document, you will see that the department investigated and found that the allegations of maltreatment were found to be substantiated, and that the security hospital failed to provide a vulnerable adult with care and services, including but not limited to food, clothing, shelter, health care, and supervision, which is reasonable and necessary. So there were two maltreatment findings against the department. As a result of those two maltreatment findings, both similar in nature, related to the way we restrained and secluded clients in the program, the commissioner ordered a fine. That fine was the maximum fine that the department can give to a facility. That fine was $2,200. The fine has since been paid to the licensing division. And finally, let me add one more thing. The department, the State Operated Services has the right to contest the fine or the finding, but the department has not done so. So we are moving ahead to try to correct the condition on the license. The final order of the commissioner was to condition the license of the facility for up to 2 years. This is a very serious action by the Department of Human Services against one of its own facilities. A correction order means that there will be additional oversight of the facility on a regular basis until all of the findings or all of the problems that created the finding of maltreatment are addressed and are corrected. The department is on a very, very rigorous and well-overseen compliance schedule. Every 30 days, we have to report back to the licensing division on our progress towards removing the, well, removing the findings that caused the condition on the license. And I can talk about some of those follow-up actions in just a moment. But I wanted to make sure that you were aware that that we understand the seriousness of this action against this facility. The level of the fine, as small as it seems, is the largest fine that can be levied by licensing, and two findings of maltreatment against vulnerable adults for seclusion and restraint is not how this program wants to be known. So we are taking corrective action. Let me take just a, if there's any questions about the findings or the correction order, I could take those now, or?
Yeah, that's fine, members. Rep. Senator Fritz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Am I correct? You received, you are under a conditional license for 2 years? Is that what you said?
Ms. Barron.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that's correct. We are under a conditioned license for 2 years. That is a condition of the license. We'd have to have licensing come talk to us about any possibility of removing that condition sooner, but we are operating as if we are under a conditioned license for 2 years.
Thank you. That answers. I want to make sure.
Thank you. Anybody else? Okay.
If not, there's one other piece of public information that we made available today. It's the investigation memorandum. It's a summary. So if you don't want to read the entire report, there is a summarized version that we made available today. Just that, in relationship to what we've done now since the correction order was given to us on December 22nd. On January 20th, we followed up because within 30 days, we have to notify any number of people of the condition on the license, including all the clients in our facilities, their guardians, the counties we work with. We blanketed notices to many, many people about the condition on our license so that they were aware that there was a condition. And we will be required to keep providing that notice that there is, in fact, a condition on the license for as long as the condition exists. Our next follow-up was then done at 60 days. We have also provided licensing with a lot of material on what we are doing to continually train staff around different kinds of restraint and seclusion procedures. We were also required to update our policies around restraint and seclusion. We are in the process of doing so. Right now, they are sitting with the licensing division so they can tell us if we've met all of their requirements or not. We are also working with our staff development people down on campus and working particularly on nonviolent communication skills. There are just a number of things that we think that we can do at least throughout the security hospital that will address a number of these findings in the licensing action. So far, we have met all the requirements for follow-up. We have no additional findings or no additional issues that have been brought to us by licensing to date. Now almost 60 days out, we are on a path toward correcting the problems that were found by licensing, and we think we're heading in the right direction. The next most important step will be approval of the policies and procedures around restraint and seclusion. There are a number of types of tools that we have used in the past to restrain and seclude clients that we will not be using anymore. We will be removing handcuffs from the facility. We will also be removing other types of restraints that we feel are not appropriate in a therapeutic environment. So all those things will be done as soon as licensing approves the final policy. That's where we are right now, Mr. Chairman, on the condition on the license. We are doing everything we can. We've met with staff. The governor traveled with the commissioner and myself down to St. Peter to the security hospital. I think there is nothing but enthusiasm and support among staff on campus at the security hospital. They are very supportive of the new direction. Staff work in clinical therapeutic environments because they care about the clients they serve for, they care for, and they want to be a part of a high quality therapeutic environment. So I would say that everybody is moving in the same direction and working very hard to remove the condition from the license.
Maybe just kind of help us a little bit. I've been on these committees 14 years, and I still try to get it all sorted out. So I'm not embarrassed to say I don't know everything about this. This is the MIND population, and how do they come to be? Are these clients, patients? What do you call them? And how many do you have, and how do they come to be with you?
Mr. Chairman, that's a really good question. In fact, I was going to actually start with a contextual piece, and I jumped ahead to the condition. So I think that is helpful as well. So this is about the Minnesota Security Hospital. It is just one portion of a number of programs located on the St. Peter campus. There are other programs, traditional programs, a forensic nursing home. We have a sex offender treatment program on the St. Peter campus. Those are all separate, though, from the security hospital, which is where the licensing action was taken. Clients that come to us at the security hospital are committed to us by the court. They are committed as mentally ill and dangerous. It's a secure treatment facility, so we do have some security, but we work to balance that off against the clearly the therapeutic needs of the client. Some clients come to us for assessment before a court determination is made about their competence to stand trial. Others are committed to us for a period of time, an indefinite period of time, while we provide therapy in the environment at the security hospital. Actually, Dr. Pratt is in a much better position to describe what we do with clients. So maybe at this point I could turn it over to him to talk about the kind of environment in which we operate.
Yeah, thanks. And I think we're interested in the topic, but I think we're kind of in a briefish mood today. And so the highlights are very helpful. And if we get into deeper discussions, I'm totally open to that. So just an overview of, do some graduate and go somewhere? And just sure. A few minutes on that would be very helpful. Welcome to the committee, Doctor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The primary set of pathology that leads to somebody being
there is... I'll have to say your name, please.
Pardon me?
Tell us your name for the...
My name is Dr. Stephen Pratt. is people who typically have psychotic illnesses and in the context of delusional thinking of paranoid persecution... decide that they need to take some sort of action to defend themselves, and they commit some sort of aggressive crime. And then through the judicial process, they're determined to be not guilty by reason of mental illness and then committed as mentally ill and dangerous. That's probably the number one scenario. So.
That was shorter than I thought. That's fine. You're really good at this. Any questions about the Representative Kiffmeyer then?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, I thought this was a very interesting situation and an interesting location. One of my questions, considering they are MID, how do you get a complaint? I mean, where does the complaint come from? Is it the vulnerable adult themselves that submits a complaint? How do you even get these kinds of complaints considering this situation, living arrangement?
Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative, the complaints can come from any number of places. They can come from clients. They can come from staff at the facility. They can come from management. It could come from anywhere, and we wouldn't know where the complaint came from because that's often we don't know who was the complaining party in a licensing action. It could come from the family member of somebody who is committed to us, a guardian of someone who is committed to us. They come from many, many different places. There's also oversight. So in addition to the oversight that's done by our licensing division, the Department of Health could be on campus. It's possible that the ombudsman would be on campus and might see something. So those complaints can come from any number of places.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Murphy.
Thanks, Mr. Chair and Commissioner Berry and Mr. Prophet. I I'm glad that we're here talking about this today. I think it's really important. I'm worried underneath the issue that we're talking about the conditional license, about the quality of care more generally for the people at the security hospital. And I know that you probably can't answer that question today. But I am wanting to know how you can assure us more generally about the quality of care. And then one very specific question, you were talking about methods of restraints and seclusion and methods that are no longer acceptable. I am curious about the methods that remain acceptable in the treatment of this population of Minnesotans.
Ms. Berry.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, to the first question, one of the other reasons that Dr. Pratt is here today is to talk about psychiatric coverage. It has certainly been a source of interest by many about the level of psychiatric services available to our clients, but also it's really the therapeutic team that is available to clients in our care. There is also a strong belief on the part of staff and managers of our facility that these two actions that brought about the maltreatment finding and the conditional license would not be exemplary of everything that happens at the security hospital. So that, in fact, in many situations, on some of the units at least, we do have staff that really do understand person-centered care, the direction that we're heading to create a high-quality care environment. So we can talk specifically about coverage if that's one of the concerns that I have. Dr. Pratt talk just a moment about that.
Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, thanks. And I just want to make sure on the record that I recognize that it's Dr. Pratt. I appreciate you being here. And if you could specifically talk about the methods of restraint and seclusion, that would help me.
Sure.
The larger question, I think, is one that we should pay attention to over time.
Okay.
Dr. Pratt.
Well, first of all, we are moving to the use of methods of seclusion and restraint that are the same in the rest of our facilities. They did use additional means of seclusion and restraint, or restraint primarily, at Mississippi Security Hospital in the past, including handcuffs and mesh wrap blankets. Those are on the way out, and we are moving to a policy around seclusion and restraint that is very much the same as what we have at our community behavioral health hospitals and the Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center. our current psychiatric coverage, we have 3.55 FTEs of psychiatric clinician covering the campus. And that is down a bit from the previous staffing level. We've been able to identify some things that don't require a psychiatrist or a forensic psychiatrist, and we've been able to reassign some duties to forensic psychologists, for example. I think when we were experiencing the exodus of a number of psychiatrists, we did have some things that did not get addressed in terms of patient care in as timely a manner as we would have liked. And so as we put coverage back in place, borrowing some clinicians from some of our other facilities, we found that we had to do a little bit of catch-up. We were playing catch-up, and I think we are very close to being caught up now. There were some acute care needs that required close psychiatric attention, and I think those things are really settling down now.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just have one final question. So I'm glad to know about the psychologist-psychiatrist issue. And I'm wondering if you can share a little bit more with the committee about the balance of the staffing that occurs. Sometimes when I think about the use of restraints, and my experience having once worked in a nursing home and a hospital is they have in the past sometimes been employed when there aren't enough staff, direct staff, on campus or present, and I'm just wondering if you can shed some light on that question for me, please.
Dr. Pratt?
I'm sorry. Thank you. I don't think that I've experienced there not being enough staff to provide quality care. I'm now, I think, in my fourth week there, so it hasn't been that long, but when I've been there, when I've been on campus, and when I've been involved in some acute situations that required a lot of attention. There have been plenty of staff around. I don't think that's the reason. I think that that it was a more of an old-fashioned approach to overseeing safety, and I think as Deputy Commissioner Berry said, the staff are very much on board about moving in a new direction and learning a new method. What I have heard very consistently since I've been there from pretty much every staff person I've talked to is, okay, we get it that the way we were doing things before is not the way we want to do things now. So what do we do? You know, teach us. We want to learn. And it's been very consistent that the staff are very interested in learning new ways.
Councilor Murphy. Councilor Laughlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Assistant Commissioner Berry and Dr. Pratt. The thing that concerns me is not so much, I appreciate the fact that you're really working hard to address restraints and appropriate use of those, but I didn't hear you saying how much you're doing to train staff in de-escalating situations and, you know, the preventative effort. And when I read, you know, the summary of at least one of the issues, it was a resident who became upset because he was not allowed to retain his Social Security card. And it sounds like from just the narrative here that this person was told, no, it had to go into a contraband box. Now, contraband has a connotation to most of us that this is something that's illegal and it's bad. And, you know, most people, particularly vulnerable adults, if they're low functioning, have been told this is really important stuff and you don't give it to anybody. You know, identity theft's an issue. And so I'm just wondering, even in that situation, it seems like when we've had other issues come up with state-operated services outside of this campus, that's been a continuing issue, is that it doesn't feel like the staff is getting enough training on how to de-escalate situations, how to build that respectful relationship that tends to see the personhood in the other person and respond to that as a way to de-escalate situations arising. And can you tell me a little bit about what you're doing in that area?
Ms. Berry.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, we have almost a year ago, a year and a half ago, we had a number of staff on a unit do a pilot around de-escalation processes. It came out of a series from SAMHSA around trauma-informed care. There was one unit that was trained. That pilot was never sort of, shall we say, it stayed a pilot. Since then, and since this conditional finding, we received emergency acquisition authority from the Department of Administration to begin training immediately on a more large-scale basis so that all staff on campus will be beneficiaries of the same kind of training that started about a year and a half ago. So that training stalled, never got further. Just last week, we began a full-scale training process across the entire agency. What we heard from staff is we need tools to move away from some of the kinds of restraints and seclusions we've used, and I want to get back to the specific ones that we still will be using. But we also want to know how to de-escalate and create that kind of therapeutic environment. Dr. Pratt has told us the same story a couple of times. Maybe you could tell your story about the telephone, which I think is extremely informative with your okay, Mr. Chairman, just as to move toward a different kind of environment on campus.
Yeah, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. this is actually an incident that happened in one of our other facilities, and it illustrates the move we're trying to make away from overseeing safety through the use of rule enforcement and toward improved safety through positive engagement. At one of our facilities, and it's an incident that I ended up reviewing as I have been doing around our system for a couple of years now, reviewing when things don't go well and trying to figure out ways to improve our processes. A staff person was sitting at the nursing station. Patient phone was on the wall over here. Patient got on the phone, was talking and starting to get upset, raising their voice, starting to yell. Staff person looked up and said, "Remember, you need to use proper phone etiquette." Patient hung up the phone, walked away. Came back a few minutes later, got on the phone, started to get worked up again, raising their voice, yelling. Staff person, "I told you, you need to use proper phone etiquette." Patient hung up the phone, left. Came back again 10 minutes later on the phone, getting angry, worked up, and the staff person says, "I told you to use proper phone etiquette." Patient ripped the phone off the wall and hit the staff over the head. Not once did the staff person say, "What's wrong? What's upsetting you?" So that is exactly the focus of where we've been working, and we have lots of training, new training that's coming in. We've been training, and one of the things about seeing change in behavior, seeing our staff do things in a different way. First of all, people don't change when they're comfortable. Right now, people at Minnesota Security Hospital are not comfortable. The conditional license, those findings, having all of this stuff in the news, people have motivation to change. And then secondly, what we found about changing behavior is that just giving people information doesn't lead to behavior change, that it really takes more of a mentoring role. So we need people doing things a different way that work shoulder to shoulder with people, that helps people learn, be able to learn by example. And so I've been down there doing that myself quite a bit, and brought in some other clinicians who also are very person-centered and trauma-informed in their approach.
Ms. Berry.
And Mr. Chairman, if I might, just the kinds of restraints that we will be using are the kinds of restraints that are authorized under the MEDO settlement, which are soft cuff restraints, and we will remove the law enforcement handcuffs from our facility.
It's 1 o'clock, by the way, if anybody cares.
Sorry. Right,
no, I'm just kidding.
Just
announcing a rare thing.
Really,
Rep. Senator Loeffler, we're taking our time, by the way. So.
Thank you. I'm glad you're approaching that. What I didn't hear you saying, and I hope as a part of that, is that you're starting first with your supervisors and management, because they set the culture, they set the attitudes, and I mean, they need to be coaches when you're trying to work with new things. And it just dismays me at how many decades we've had this sort of institutional mindset in our state-operated services. And when you dehumanize people, no matter what their challenges are, it changes the outcomes. And it makes it much more difficult for the therapeutic process. It makes it much harder for the person who's struggling with issues that none of us hope we ever confront to deal with it. And excessive use of restraints is clearly showing that there's some issues that we need to deal with. And I look forward to hearing the results of your increased training, because I do think that we've got a problem, and it's not just on this campus. We've heard about it from other places, and I'm glad you're tackling it.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Ms. Berry and Dr. Pratt, I agree that, qualified personnel and you have the training, those things are really good. But the thing that concerns me about this particular allegation 4 is that there were facility staff persons, meaning more than one, and sleeping on a concrete floor or on a concrete slab for 25 nights. No matter what good policies you have in place, it can happen occasionally that somebody doesn't follow policy and doesn't use good judgment either. What concerns me here is 25 nights and more than one person. That's a pretty serious level of repeated offense in a very harsh way, and that there were more than one person, because often, if it's one, you might be able to do that. Could you respond to why that could occur to that degree?
Ms. Berry.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, we share that level of concern, which is why we've made some changes in direction and supervision around and oversight of the facilities in correcting the condition. That any client would be on a cement floor for 25 days is not only a serious problem, it's really, as you say, remarkable that nobody else stepped in that environment. So that started from the top of the facility to a number of supervisory and managerial staff that were in, not just direct care staff. There were other people who knew about this. Most of those people are no longer at the facility. We've made some changes in direction and leadership at the facility so that we should never find ourselves in a position where a client was on a cement floor for this period of time, or any of the other findings in this investigation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And so, Ms. Berry, what, you know, I understand the fact that you've taken care of this particular situation, but what is it in the future that when you have an opportunity for someone, I mean, you have policies, procedures, do all those things, and you have something that's an exception. I know that in some facilities they have an evening supervisor, night supervisor, you know, they have kind of these shifting things, and that they're responsible to do a walkthrough mm-hmm. and to look for those things. Most of the time in this kind of a situation, that, especially if someone is having a particular disciplinary action being taken, those should be especially looked at. But what is it that you feel that would help even something like an exception from not going on that long?
Ms. Berry.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, we've had a similar incident, not exactly like this incident, but one like it since the condition on the license, and licensing hasn't finished their investigation, so we don't know what they will do, but there are different things that we did in that situation. We had somebody who was restrained and was put in seclusion for a period of time. It's been much publicized, so I can talk about it here, without any clothing in a seclusion room for an extended period of time. In that case, we took very swift action for those who were responsible and were in charge and gave the order around that restraint and seclusion, and those staff are no longer with us in the department. Incidents like that are raised to our level very quickly so that we can provide the kind of oversight that needs to take place as a result of what happened. I mean, what actually happened here happened almost 18 months ago, and we only got the condition on the license in December. But there's different things you can do to hold people accountable for the actions they take or the orders that they give and the ones that staff follow on the unit. So an incident reporting system that very quickly makes its way to the commissioner's office so that we can provide oversight and review. In the most recent instance, it was a nurse on the unit who actually came onto the unit and provided a blanket, pillow, and clothing for the client after the physician left the unit. So we do have staff who care. We do have staff who raise these issues to us. I think the condition on the license has also placed the facility under a very different kind of focus, and that staff will raise issues when they know there are problems. So an incident reporting system that we think makes its way right to the highest levels and provides that kind of oversight is one of the ways, well, and taking actions that hold people accountable for how they treat clients are, I think, two very important parts of what we've added to this process.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I hope that indeed it's one thing to happen, but catching them quickly and dealing with them, you can't prevent all the incidents, they just are, but catching quickly, acting quickly, that's the part that I find encouraging, and hopefully that will be the case in the future. Thank you.
And we have Representative Morrow and then Lane, and then we'll take the testimony of the other two witnesses. Representative Morrow, welcome to the committee.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you.
I think you want to come back here again sometime and spend some time with us. It's a great
well,
committee.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. And I think my question might be for Dr. Pratt. Dr. Pratt, at one point there were 9 psychiatrists on staff. You mentioned, I think, a decimal number. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us, moving forward, what the plan is with the psychiatric staff, what your staffing levels would be, and one of the concerns we had heard about psychiatrists not actually seeing clients. So moving forward, what are your plans for treatment that involves psychiatrists and the rest of the staff? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Oh, sure. Dr. Pratt.
Thank you. We currently have approval for hiring 4 psychiatrists and 3 psychiatric advanced practice nurses, so we'll and then a medical director position. So we will be up to approximately 8. Not all of them are full time. I can't speak to the accountability or lack of accountability that existed under previous medical leadership. I can say that that as I'm there as the interim medical director, we will hire people with a set of expectations about schedules they will keep. and accountabilities for patient care, and I will personally oversee that accountability.
Representative Morrow, follow up? Okay. Representative Lane.
Well, I think that answered my question. I just want to emphasize that we talk about the individual incidents, but at the same time, what we really need to look at is who's accountable at the upper end, and that's where I want to see the focus.
You want to react to that? Okay. Well, let's take the testimony, Ms. Abbeholden and Ms. Orpheim. You both want to come down as... Oh, there she is. Yeah, you guys can sit side by side, and then if there's other questions for the department, we can, you know, include you if you'd like to have any discussion. And that's Ms. Abderholden. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota, and I want to thank you for the opportunity to comment on the situation at the Minnesota Security Hospital. NAMI's main concern is that people with serious mental illnesses are provided care that is therapeutic, that they are treated with dignity and respect, and that they are in an environment that is safe. I think it's critically important that members of this committee remember that the license of the state-operated facility was placed on conditional status due to determinations of maltreatment, this just months after a settlement on the abuses that occurred at MEDO. If you haven't read the reports, I would again encourage you to do so, and to read about a person sleeping on a slab of concrete for 25 nights. Spit rags, which are mesh bags placed over a patient's head, were used, as were handcuffs. People were placed in protective isolation for days on end, and seclusion and restraints were used for non-emergency situations. In sum, there were clearly massive problems with the culture and atmosphere for patients at St. Peter. Since the 1999 Hartford Current revelations of the deaths and serious injuries suffered by people who were subject to physical and mechanical restraints, there's been a great deal of work in the field on this subject, both in Minnesota and around the country. Every single major organization has developed position papers against these procedures and supported training programs to reduce their use. Charles Curie, who was head of Pennsylvania's Mental Health and Substance Abuse Department, who really started the first effort in terms of a statewide effort, said that seclusion and restraint are not treatment. They actually reflect treatment failure. It does take a planned effort to reduce the use of seclusion restraints. It's not something that just ends in one day. You need data collection and analysis, strategies for organizational change, staff training and crisis prevention and intervention, risk assessment and treatment planning tools, consumer debriefing methods, recovery-based treatment models, and an adequate number of staff. I want to make sure that you understand that seclusion and restraints do not change behaviors. There are absolutely no studies out there that say that they change behavior. The only reason to use seclusion restraint is when there is imminent danger that someone will hurt themselves or others, so really only in an emergency. It's not to change behavior, it's not for punishment, and it's not for the convenience of staff. Their use is to end when the threat of harm ends, and they should only be used by trained staff. Using seclusion restraint actually costs money. One-time motion task study found that it costs $302 to $354 per one restraint episode. Using restraints can actually lead to more staff injuries and workers' comp claims, especially if there haven't been appropriate training. The individual or patient may experience physical injuries, but also experience harm to their interpersonal relationships, damage to the therapeutic alliance, and mistrust of the healthcare system and providers. It takes a great deal of work to take a program or facility and reduce the use of seclusion restraints. There has to be leadership at the top, the commissioner and the head of the Minnesota Security Hospital stating that this is in fact a goal and that there is no going back. And there must be cultural change within an institution. Albert Einstein said it's not possible to solve a problem with the same consciousness that created it. Studies show that when facilities truly embrace and implement a reduction in the use of seclusion and restraints, you can see an increase in staff satisfaction, decreased staff turnover, reduction in use of sick time, and a reduction in staff injuries. For the patients, they too see fewer injuries, shorter length of stays, decreased hospitalization, increased positive outcomes, and less medication use. About 2 years ago, the effort to reduce seclusion restraints was begun at St. Peter. In June of 2010, there were over 9,200 hours of people being in restraint, seclusion, or protective isolation. By June 2011, those numbers had dropped down to 315. This is a significant change. Frankly, NAMI's main concern is not which psychiatrists stay at St. Peter, but that we have enough to treat people and that they buy into the new philosophy. It's not which staff stay working there, but that we have staff that are committed to creating a therapeutic environment. This is a direction that is much needed, and we want the department to continue on this path. Thank you.
Questions or comments for Ms. Abderholden? Thank you. I appreciate your passion, and you said it very well. Ms. Opheim, welcome.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Roberta Opheim. I'm the State Ombudsman for Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities. I want to talk very briefly about how we got in the mess that we were in when the changes that came about that needed to occur. Over the years, our office has had concerns regarding the care and treatment of clients and possible violation of their rights at this particular program because of the very nature of the program and the propensity for institutions to become sort of incestuous or groupthink. Our concern with this particular program increased after the Minnesota Sex Offender Program started to grow and develop on the St. Peter campus. Even after the Moose Lake was built, there was continued pressure on MSOP, and there was a continued presence of it at the St. Peter campus. However, our concerns gradually increased after the State Operated Services Administration created what was known as the Forensic Services Division, which then put MSOP, Security Hospital, and the Minnesota Extended Treatment Options all under the same administration. Gradually led to common policies, common procedures, and staff training. It also led to the mixing of staff to work sometimes in the sex offender program, sometimes in the security hospital. These are very clinically different populations, each with their own need of treatment for their own issues or disability that led to whatever the problem behavior was. As MSOP became more punitive in nature, so did the security hospital and the Minnesota Extended Treatment Options. There was an increased use of restraints, including metal handcuffs, leg hobbles, as well as seclusion and protective isolation. In many cases, the client was not engaged in dangerous behavior, but rather simply was not able or willing to comply with the rules. For some, they did not understand the rules, or the rules were countertherapeutic to their treatment needs. In 2007 or 2008, DHS recognized that MSOP had to be separated from disability-based programs and brought in Dennis Benson to take over the MSOP program. However, for MSH and MEDO, the ingrained practices continued. In 2008, some of you may remember the Ombudsman wrote a report about the use of restraints at the Minnesota Extended Treatment Programs. This was a major report about the conditions of and nature of the treatment being provided there. Actions there violated the civil and human rights with the excessive use of restraints. DHS has just recently settled a federal lawsuit over the conditions and have been ordered to make proactive changes for all people with disabilities, not just those with developmental disabilities. As a result, some of the clients who were at MEDO with high uses of restraints were transferred to the security hospital. This prompted the Ombudsman to go to State Operated Services Administration and suggest that if the use of restraints at the security hospital didn't recede, that another report might be needed covering the security hospital, not just the MEDO program. Some of those changes began to occur, but subsequently they did receive a grant for technical assistance of trauma-informed care. However, security hospital lacked strong centralized leadership. The administrative and line staff reported to the hospital administrator. The clinical staff reported to the medical director. There was no one vision for the program. Things reached a point where the Joint Commission came in and clearly identified that they were not operating the program in a way that was appropriate, especially as it relates to seclusion and restraint. That was then followed by the DHS licensing report. No one seemed to hold anybody accountable for the problems that were occurring in the program. I want to emphasize that there are many excellent employees who go to work every day at the security hospital trying to do the best job they can with the resources made available to them and with the training that they've been given. But I think that it's time to provide them with the tools that they need in order to do that job in the appropriate way. Many of the line staff who were there were intimidated not to speak up, or punished if they didn't follow the rapidly changing directives of the program. That's not the way to achieve system reform. System reform has to be achieved by training, by mentoring, by many of the methods that you've had there. I've had a chance to talk to many of them, and they really do want to change. In 2010, or approximately sometime thereafter, the department finally realized that they needed major leadership changes and major directional changes. The Ombudsman supports that effort to make the change. After years of constantly raising issues, we felt that the department recognized the problem. But change doesn't come easy. And when you were on at the lowest point and recognized the need for change, there will be chaos. The important thing is not to change horses in midstream or the captain of the ship during a storm. It's much more important to work diligently day after day on making the changes necessary as rapidly as possible, providing staff with the training and the tools. I do not want to see the focus go in the direction it has been going in the media, where we're talking about personalities and those types of things, because that's not what this program is about. This program is about the clients being served. And I think that we need to return our focus to that. This program is very expensive, and it's in everyone's best interest to work towards making the residents better and returning them to society. I don't want us to lose sight of that. I want us to recognize that for clients to be safe, staff need to be safe. It's better for everyone. There's less injuries to clients, less injuries to staff, and everyone feels better about the work they do. Restraints are traumatizing, not just to the person being restrained, but to the staff who have to implement them and to the other clients who have to witness them. And as Ms. Abderholden said, they don't work to change behavior. So I think the time has come for this change. The Office of Ombudsman will continue to assist in whatever way we can to make sure that positive change happens there. We'll also continue to push the department when we think they're going off track. With that, I would stand for any questions.
Professor Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Oppheim, I'm wondering, I agree that we're on a path, and I'm glad that we're on it. But I'm wondering if there's any benchmarks that we might have you and the department work on that we can actually see as a goal and as a progress. I mean, I'm sure that many states have facilities that handle their most challenging of patients. And, you know, if we might be able to have some work done on establishing sort of you know, where we're at on a baseline in terms of use of restraints and, you know, those sorts of things, and compare that to some benchmarks across others so we can actually see without having to go through patient records and, you know, question whether this situation or that situation was right, whether or not we're seeing our moving to sort of best practices. And this is not an area I know a lot about, but I'm wondering if we might be able to do something like that.
Ms. Oppheim, sorry. Somehow I got an R stuck in your name, and I don't know how. It's just in my head, and I have
to. I usually respond to anything that people call me.
Please accept my failure and proceed.
Chair, Representative Loeffler, I couldn't agree more that there has to be measurement tools, quality assessments to know when you, in fact, are meeting your goals. And it recalls one of my favorite stories. Certainly we can look at seclusion restraint, we can look at staff injuries, but in the past I've never been confident that those statistics were an accurate reflection of what was going on, because we always heard, well, we're reducing seclusion restraints. Then I found out that they didn't even realize that they weren't measuring the majority of restraints that we're using, which was the handcuffs during transport, which clearly was a form of restraint also. So I think that there are benchmarks on injuries, number of restraints, but also on how clients feel about their therapeutic alliance with the staff that they have to work with. Do they run away from staff, or do they seek staff out for help? I don't know what all those benchmarks are, but I've been attending a lot of programs around the country that have worked tremendously towards the total elimination of the use of seclusion and restraints. And in the trauma-informed care work group that is engaging on campus, there are two consumers who are actually part of it. And I literally was blown away by their unique insight and their talent that they brought to the committee. And in the very first meeting where one of them attended, a young man basically asked better questions about how the program knew or would know if it was succeeding than I had ever heard discussed in some of the higher level policy discussions around this. And so, do I know what those benchmarks are? No. Do I think we need to absolutely have them and develop them? We do, and I think we can look to other states, but we should look to the clients first to tell us whether they feel they're getting better or not. And in many cases, what was done to them made them worse. So I think we have some healing to do, but I think we need to listen to the clients, to the families who support those clients. I can't tell you how many family members have told me that they've been sort of pushed aside by the treatment program and not engaged, even though the family will be part of their life for the rest of their lives, but hopefully the program will only be part of their life for a short period of time. So hopefully we will get those benchmarks, and they should be able to be reported to you.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you. And I've seen, I just, for people who are watching on TV and can't see us, I want to note that there are some people from the department nodding their heads through that discussion. So I think this discussion will continue, and thank you to both parties for being willing to take it on.
Representative Loeffler, we're just on audio today. So last week we were on TV every day.
They couldn't hear the head nod either.
So, yeah, but they can't hear the head nods, hopefully. Well, I want to thank the all the people that testified today, the department, and Ms. Adderholden and Ms. Oppheim, with no R. This is a hugely sensitive topic. It's very important. It's, some parts of this are ugly, and some parts are rays of hope. And so I think that this committee has shown its interest in helping the process to move better. Government's not perfect, but it means well, and we want to make it actually function well. Maybe I overstate that. So thank you for that. I guess we're through with this part. Who would like to have the first minutes of the new maps? Representative Liebling, do you want to take another crack at this? And would that be all right? Representative Liebling moves the minutes. Any questions about that? Any witnesses that want to testify? Representative Hayden, want to say he's not here? Anyway, all those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed. I think we're done, and we have a bill tomorrow and some other reports this week. So, thanks, and enjoy the maps.